Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 31, and today I'm joined by Ryan Drake, assistant professor of philosophy at Fairfield University and graduate of the Pennsylvania State University's Department of Philosophy. Ryan's work focuses on aesthetics, politics, ancient philosophy, critical theory, hermeneutics, and 19th and 20th century continental philosophy. He's published numerous articles in these areas, including most recently an article entitled Wonder, Nature, and the Ends of Tragedy in International Philosophical Quarterly in 2010, Devices of Shock, Adorno's Aesthetics of Film, and Fritz Lang's Fury in Telos, and I'll put the references to these on the blog post. And he's published an article that is related to our discussion today entitled Extraneous Voices, Orphaned and Adopted Texts in the Protagoras, which was published in Epoche in 2005. I'm very grateful that Ryan has agreed to join me today because not only did he publish this article in Epoche, but also his dissertation here at Penn State was on the Protagoras entitled The Limit of Life, The Ethics of Discourse in Plato's Protagoras. He's generously agreed to come to the Digital Dialogue to discuss the paper that I'll be giving at the Ancient Philosophy Society later on this month in April at Michigan State, and that paper is entitled The Crisis of Community, The Topology of Socratic Politics in the Protagoras. So this is actually going to be a little bit of a different digital dialogue than those in the past because I've found an expert to come and ask me some questions about the Protagoras, and hopefully we'll have a good discussion about the Protagoras. So welcome, Ryan, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. And I would just say at the start, I've had a great time listening to a number of the digital dialogues before. And I think it's really a great, at some points, really an amazing service to have at your fingertips here. I feel like I've learned a lot listening to some of the folks you've had on and being interviewed.
Oh, it's been really a remarkable experience just to do it. I mean, it's been I'm amazed that we've already this is the 31st one. So it's been fun, and I think part of the and this is related to what we'll be talking about today. But part of the strategy here is to see what happens when you expose your own research and some of your research interests to the public, even though. On the one hand, this is kind of an intimate setting, even though you're on Skype and we're miles apart. There's something about the voice and something about the sound of voices, as opposed to video and writing, that sure. Lends itself to dialogue in an interesting way. And I know that's a theme that we'll be talking about in some depth, I imagine, in relation to the Protagoras.
Yeah, I hope so.
So, I mean, I'm going to let you ask me some questions, but paper in Epoche has this, you know, this talks a lot about extraneous voices and also focuses on the issue of what it would mean or what it means when to speak in one's own voice is what Socrates sort of brings out after his critique of Protagoras's vision of education.
Certainly, yeah, and I think it dovetails quite nicely with some of the observations that you make about what it might mean to speak in one's own voice. Mm-hmm. On the Socratic definition here. And I know there's a reference to Charles Griswold's great essay,
right.
Speaking in One's Own Voice, mm-hmm. in the Protagoras as well. So it naturally involves these issues of sort of openness and responsibility, and also in particular care with respect to the person that you're dealing with, that mm-hmm. I think you also bring out quite nicely fairly early on in your essay, the kind of care that Socrates has for Hippocrates when they set out to go to Protagoras.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that struck me in thinking about the text. I mean, I think one thing that's been important for me to in terms of the whole project of thinking about what is the meaning of Socratic politics is that it's always focused on an individual.
Right.
You know, he doesn't take power, he doesn't lead the many. Or actually, maybe the better way to put it is he does, in a certain way, he leads many by engaging one. You know, so in that sense, I felt like this was a really unique kind of approach to politics, and it comes off of that phrase from the Gorgias when Socrates is talking to Callicles and saying that he's the only one to try his hand at the true art of politics. And so I'm thinking, well, sort of what does that mean, and what would politics mean if we really did take seriously the discussions we have with one another on an individual level as inherently and importantly political?
Right. And just along these lines, I think that we see very poignantly where Socrates fails when he attempts to address the many, which is, of course, an apology.
Right.
Where his attempt, his best efforts at clearing himself, which seem always to be quite persuasive, or at the very least shows the accusations against him to be groundless, still don't have enough weight when considered against, say, the frame of a large audience of people.
Right.
You definitely see where there can't be a dialogue, where there can only be a platform in which one person gives one speech. There seems to be a kind of atrophication of the power of dialogue as well.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, it's striking me, as it has in the past, that the state of contemporary politics in the United States certainly is caught up in that problem, where you have this series of people speaking at one another, and less often do you have genuine instances of dialogue where whereas, as I guess Socrates says toward the end of the Protagoras, a speaking and listening in turn with one another. And so the sign of the educated person, and that's where I sort of was trying to go toward the end of the text was to emphasize, well, what would that mean to speak and listen in turn with one another, recognizing, as I think I've also learned here in doing the Digital Dialogue podcast, is, it's difficult to stop talking and to listen. So there's a tempo to it.
Yeah, certainly. Not just the sort of recognizing that you have to get involved in a kind of give and take, but as well we have this sort of sense of obviousness with respect to dialogue, where we assume that we know how to engage in a dialogue properly from the start. And this is something that Socrates sort of harps on in the Protagoras, whereas to learn how to give and take logoi, as he says, is no easy skill. And when Protagoras tries his hand at it, he seems to fail miserably.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, it really is something for me to think about too, because just as Hippocrates assumes that what he's going to get from Protagoras is a good education, I think we assume we know how to do this, but in fact, I think we, and this being dialogue, have a genuine discussion where we allow ourselves to be moved by the other, and also hope to move the other as well. But we don't, and I don't know how we learn it in some ways. I mean, I guess this is really related to the idea of learning virtue, right? In the text, can it be taught, or what would the nature of the teaching be? In some ways, it has to be performative.
Right, and I think there has to be an element of initiative and spontaneity there. So when I talk about openness, it also involves a kind of favoring of the other person from the start. And one of the things that Socrates says to Protagoras around the middle of the dialogue is, or actually after they've had their little expositions of what the poem means in the dialogue. Socrates says, "Well, if you're done with your questions, then put yourself at my service, so that I can start asking you questions again. Or if not, if you have more to say, I will put myself at your service."
Right.
So it seems that there has to be as well a kind of generosity from the start in having an actual dialogue. And where at the point of the dialogue where it seems like everything breaks down, as you say, it breaks down precisely because Protagoras and Socrates don't seem to be willing to give much in terms of how long they want their speeches to be.
Right.
And this is where Protagoras says, well, should they be longer than they're supposed to be? Shorter? And so he's kind of holding his ground. But he's not... neither he nor Socrates, I think, at that point, are really willing there to, at least in that moment, are really willing to give some ground, which actually leads to that rupture in the middle of the dialogue that, as you say, is actually pretty much the sort of center, is the point of crisis.
Right.
So the question of learning how to actually have a dialogue, which is quite funny when you think about it, between someone who's in maybe his late 30s and then Protagoras, who's quite old, two people coming together to try and figure out how do we actually have a conversation in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things there that I wanted to maybe we could circle back to. One is the question of time of life and where Socrates is in his life. I think it's very significant. I tried to make some points about that, sort of the course of his life and this conversation being at a specific juncture in that course. And I think it's significant that he's youngish, Socrates, at this time.
I would love to talk about that as well, just because it changed a lot of my thinking about the dialogue in general.
In what sense?
Well, the way you started, I remember talking to you some months ago, and we sort of had a disagreement, first of all, about the opening frame of the dialogue.
Right.
Whereas you were seeing the sort of the unnamed friend of Socrates as someone who had been expecting him.
Right.
And this is where the hora, you know, comes into play, actually reading the dialogue with this attention to the sort of proper time.
Right.
As you say, a sort of a time of one's life.
Right.
And then it comes back to sort of the proper time at the end of the dialogue in which Protagoras says, all right, now it's, and he uses hora again, and he says, now it's time to turn to something else.
Right.
As if a sort of turn away from a conversation about the good could actually be justified there at the end of the dialogue. But it also made me think again, because I thought it was something of an open question whether Socrates had actually left with Hippocrates,
mm-hmm.
if you recall.
Do you think, yeah, I remember that. Do you think I justified that enough? I mean, my justification comes down to, you know, the first person plural there at the end. Were you convinced?
I actually was. I was convinced.
Right.
that's right. You can chalk that up on your...
If I had an agonistic view to dialogue, I would put a point on my score, but I don't.
No, exactly. I'll let you rack those up, and then we'll sort of take an account at the end of our dialogue.
Well, and actually, it brings up, by the way, I do want to circle back to what you're saying, but it does bring up the issue that you bring up, which is the notion of what is the role of playfulness? Because, you know, you and I can joke about and be playful, and it's one of the things I always enjoy about talking with you, is that we can disagree about something philosophically, but we always, you know, it's never it ends in this sort of agonistic anger or anything like that. We can have a kind of playfulness to it. That's fun. It's important.
Oh, right. And as well, I think it's perfectly fitting that we're coming together to talk about this dialogue in particular, because when I chose this as the subject of my dissertation, what originally drew me to it more than anything sort of substantive or really thematic was the notion of playfulness being so prominent in the dialogue. It was something I loved about it. It's not just fun and funny, but also just very, very playful.
Can you talk a little bit more? I mean, so I have on my notes here, we need to come back to the time of life issue and how that's changed some of your views on it. But I'd like to hear more about your own view of the dimension of play in the dialogue.
Right. Well, it seems to me that where people who want to read this dialogue are really looking at some kind of hard and fast distinction between sophistry and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me as I was reading the dialogue that Socrates seems to take on so many different voices here in the dialogue, to the point at which you might wonder, is he shifting from philosophy to sophistry?
Right.
Is he trying to imitate Protagoras? Is he, when he seems to be poking fun at Protagoras, maybe bringing in Prodicus, for example,
right.
or something, are these just kind of oblique ad hominem attacks? Or are these ways of just sort of showing how a dialogue can be spontaneous and somewhat playful while entertaining a number of different subjects that may or may not bear upon the real heart of the dialogue, which mm-hmm. it's up to any interpreter to try and figure out what that might be.
Exactly.
But it seems that the serious reader of the dialogue is bound to be disappointed if he's looking at, if he wants to look at a kind of serious Socrates that will take one through, say, a diuresis of different, I guess, of different forms of something in particular. He's not engaging in that. It seems like the dramatic role of the dialogue is front and center here.
Yeah.
Which also includes not just Socrates' erotic relations, but also points in which Socrates himself seems to be rather frustrated, as if he's playing too much, for example.
Right, right. No, that makes sense. And I think Socrates himself, you know, that makes actually the point that you were making in your article about the how we're going to read the Simonides interpretation and how we understand, you know, interpretation in general. Really important, because, you know, to take the dialogue seriously doesn't mean to read the playfulness out of it.
Right. Right. And I think that hermeneutic section there in particular is actually quite helpful for seeing the play in the dialogue as well, not just in referring to Prodicus for help and sort of jesting with Protagoras over the different meanings of, say, hard and bad, for example.
Right.
But also Socrates' own long soliloquy about where, you know, where philosophy comes from, right, seems to map onto Protagoras' great speech at the beginning, where in fact now he is, I guess, he's elevating not just the Spartans but as well the Cretans as being the sort of masters of philosophy, which any of the Athenians at that point would have found laughable.
Right, right, right. I mean, yeah, there's definitely, and yet, you know, what is he teaching us about, and this you address in your article nicely, but, you know, what is he teaching us about how to read, you know, these Platonic texts, and how is our approach to those texts determined by this very enigmatic kind of interpretation? And as I think you point out, it's one of the earliest interpretations in all of literature, right?
Right, right. Yeah, certainly you don't find anything that really goes more into depth on the question of interpretation before that, or at least I haven't found anything like that. But what Socrates seems to exemplify here is, again, a kind of initial generosity with respect to the poem that he's looking at. So there's this assumption someone has something to say and that they are competent in saying it. So that mm-hmm. if we are attuned correctly to the text, what might seem like a kind of superficial contradiction, for example, like the one that Protagoras points out, actually through our thinking about it and perhaps talking about it might reveal a more fundamental kind of consistency that we can learn from.
Right. Right, yeah, and I mean, and that's what makes that Simonides interpretation so interesting, because on the one hand, you feel like, this is, and people have said this and interpreted it this way, this is just a kind of, you know, a break in the action, it's not really related, and of course, anytime somebody's saying that, you're thinking,
sure,
this is ridiculous,
right.
Okay, so, yeah. But yet, the content, some of the distinctions that Socrates makes in that discussion are in fact related directly to the question of what does it mean to be good, what does it mean to act well, and so it's, of course, even thematically, in terms of its content, related directly to the whole question of virtue and whether it can be taught.
Yeah, certainly. And I find that those sections on techne and those who, as he says, tend to get knocked down by irresistible mischance, as he puts it,
mm-hmm.
quite interesting as well, insofar as they can bear upon Protagoras, who least of all wants to be seen as someone who could be bested by anything,
right,
outside of himself. And there's a really interesting interplay there as well between, say, voluntary action, willing action, but also compulsion and constraint,
right,
or ananke, as it's used there.
Right.
And I see you calling attention to ananke as well, and maybe we can use this to go back into the Hora and
into
your paper. There's that moment of compulsion where Callias grasps Socrates when he wants to get up. and leave precisely because it seems like it's a waste of his time to stay there any longer. Or, again, as you say, he really has somewhere to go.
Right.
And now that this is the meeting with his unnamed friend seems to take precedence now that there's no progress that he can make with Protagoras in the dialogue.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I took that to be, and I think I have, there are a number of interesting things that happen at that point, right, where Callias takes, physically touches and holds Socrates there. You know, I'm reminded of the beginning, obviously, of the Republic, where Socrates is also physically held, and then the question of the question of compulsion and force in relation to politics is an urgent one throughout the Republic, and I think there's something similar is going on here, especially since, you know, the logic and the dynamics associated with this touching is really critical. Now, what animates Callias to actually physically reach out and touch Socrates is, I think there's a lot of things involved in that, but I do feel like that was a moment where, okay, now, if in fact I'm right that Socrates is willingly there because he cares about Hippocrates and he wants to make sure Hippocrates doesn't make a bad decision about the most important thing in the world, namely the education of his soul, then Callias's interest is obviously somewhat different, right? Callias is this really rich guy.
He wants, you know, he wants further entertainment. He's the host. He wants everyone to have a good time, and it seems like Socrates' encounter with Protagoras is the best thing that they've had going yet.
and not
just that, but it has been a way to bring everyone together, whereas at the start that they were divided, Protagoras walking with his crew, Prodicus just sitting there indoors, wrapped up in what were they, rugs or blankets?
Right.
And Hippias as well, sitting on some kind of higher stool, declaiming about the universe. But I also thought this moment with Callias was particularly interesting because, while on the one hand it is a moment of compulsion, he's also requesting a favor from Socrates, as he says.
Right.
So
and Socrates,
do us this favor. And whereas originally I had thought the primary boundaries of the dialogue as a whole, I had always conceived in terms of the favor itself as kind of foreshadowing what is going to be necessary for a productive kind of dialogue
along
the Socratic line. So you have the double favor at the start when the unnamed friend says, well, you know, it would be, you know, Socrates says to the unnamed friend, it would be a favor if I could tell this to you. And the friend says, it would be a favor for us to listen. So they start out with this, I think it's duplis charis, the sort of double favor.
Right.
And it's mentioned back at the end, as you say, when Socrates leaves, he said, well, I had just stayed as a favor to Callias.
Right. I mean, and this brings us right to your issue of, or you were bringing the question of what does it mean to be open, and the question of doing favors and being there's this sort of generosity involved in all of this. In fact, there's a way in which Socrates is doing all kinds of favors in this dialogue.
Very much so.
Right? And of course, we need to make sure that we remember that doing favors also has this erotic undertone to it always, or maybe overtone. I don't know. It's always... and so that brings, you know, out this whole question of the role of the erotic, and I mean that in the richest sense of the term, in terms of animating our lives toward the kinds of questions that Socrates does end up wanting to address, namely, and being frustrated that Protagoras is not willing to continue with toward the end, not only whether virtue can be taught, but what exactly it is that this thing we're calling arete. So I think that erotic drive is also bound up with this notion of doing favors and of being willing to do certain things that you might not otherwise do because you are interested not only in the course of your own life, but the course of the lives of the people around you and the people you care about.
Right, and I think this is where Eros comes very close to epimeleia.
Mm-hmm. To caring, then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, to care, right? Yeah. Which is repeated several times in Socrates' exchange with Hippocrates. I think maybe even 10 times it shows up there in his interaction with Hippocrates before they leave to go see Protagoras.
Uh-huh.
So I think that there is this notion of this sort of erotic kind of attraction, but the question is this an Eros that is aimed towards the communal well-being of of individuals involved?
Right.
And another thing interesting about your paper is I was following the sort of course of that first aura,
mm-hmm.
and then it seems to be interrupted by another.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Socrates has the proper time that he wants to see his unnamed friend, but this is interrupted, and you note quite well, I think, the number of interruptions that come up within the dialogue, where it seems like a new proper time is going to emerge just in your dealing with particular individuals.
Right. Right, and I think that's right. I mean, that's a good point that... you know, I'm actually trying right now, just thinking about how that might map out. I've been trying to think a little bit more about the Gorgias and how this would play into the Gorgias, because I mean, the amount of time spent with each of the interlocutors in the Gorgias is an interesting phenomenon. Because what determines the proper time in this context is not necessarily Well, it is in part, I guess, the kind of discussion that you're able to have with the person.
Right.
But also, again, I think it goes back to openness. I mean, obviously, Socrates spends most of his time in this dialogue with Hippocrates, with this young man who's wondering if he should, or who's convinced at first he should take up with Protagoras. And I think that your comment earlier does a nice job of really capturing the way in which that community that was happening at Callias's house was dispersed. It was sort of each one showing off his own kind of thing, having his individual conversation. Callias, therefore, as host, probably is really interested in the fact that Socrates has managed somehow to bring them all together. And so that's, I think I need to do a little bit more thinking as I think about revising this paper also, about the sort of, because I it turned out for me that this dialogue in an important way is about learning communities and the nature of them.
Yeah.
And that image of Griswold does a really nice job of sort of showing or rehearsing that scene when Protagoras is just sort of giving forth and people are following him, and then he turns and they split.
Oh, right.
They split, and he walks between them, and they sort of make way for him. And this is this sort of image of the, from my perspective, it's the image of the lecturer, you know, the person, the teacher who wants disciples and doesn't really listen, doesn't really want to hear the voice of the students, and doesn't really care about the lives of the students, just sort of going about his or her business. And, you know, whether there are students are actually hearing the things that are said in some ways secondary, it seems sometimes.
Yeah, well, I think that this is also where the question of a lack of unity or kind of dispersion bears upon the form of the discourse itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the criticism of Protagoras is that his long speeches make it difficult to hold together the things that he says. Right? Mm-hmm. And this is where Alcibiades proves himself to be wise to what Protagoras is doing. He says he's spinning out arguments until people have forgotten what they've even been about.
Right.
And Socrates himself admits to being sort of enchanted or caught under Protagoras's sway for a few moments even after Protagoras has finished his great speech.
Right.
So I think there's this kind of there's this unfortunate effect of a dispersion, at least in one's thoughts,
mm-hmm.
in which they cannot be held together in a particular unity, which would provide someone with a kind of resource. So what what Protagoras' discourse seems to do is actually disarm the individual, and by default, it becomes persuasive.
Right.
And this seems to be Protagoras' brand of persuasion here. The beautiful, dazzling speech whose unity the listeners have lost in the face of the pleasure that they get from hearing it.
Right, right. No, I think that's right. And obviously that's such a, that resonates so much with a lot of the kind of political speech we hear in contemporary culture. But I wonder if we're not, I mean, I always get worried that we're not giving Protagoras enough credit at certain times. Because, right, Socrates does emphasize at one point, I don't think he's completely, being completely facetious about this, Pythagoras has these two really important abilities. Namely, he can answer questions when he's asked, and can ask questions himself, and have the patience to consider the replies. I think I was looking at that 329 B and C in that area, and I think in some ways Pythagoras does show himself to be able to do some of that. What he's absolutely, I think, incapable of doing is cultivating that in others.
Yeah. Well, I've been wondering about this as well. And it seems to me what Protagoras is attending to when he's in the midst of a dialogue with Socrates is he doesn't seem to be used to, but he can give and, give a logos and accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not seem to be particularly well oriented to the overall course of the dialogue. What, for example, what is going to delimit a proper subject matter, for example, on which to talk?
Mm-hmm.
So, and just to sort of flesh that out a little bit more, he seems to fall into these traps early on in the dialogue when Socrates starts asking him about the relation of the virtues to one another.
Right.
This interesting imagery of the face or of gold.
Yeah, what did you make of that? I mean, we'd had a long discussion about that in class last semester when we were talking about this, and the analogy being that how do the virtues relate to one another? Is it like pieces of gold, right? All sort of qualitatively the same, but divisible in a quantitative way, or are they qualitatively different, but do they make up like a face, like the eyes and the nose and the mouth of a face, something or some organic whole? And I was, absolutely uncompelled by the gold analogy, but as some of the students were pointing out, that Socrates continues to come back to that, and there's a way in which I felt like Socrates had too homogeneous a conception of the differences between the virtues. I actually thought what Pythagoras says is, well, actually, they're different, but they're different in different ways.
Right. Right. And of course he doesn't exactly clarify the ways in which they're different,
right,
which is a particular problem that maybe we could talk about in a little bit in relation to this theme of measurement.
Well, but just the one point about that, I felt like Socrates didn't give Protagoras enough credit at that point. Like at certain point, Socrates seemed, and maybe I'm misreading it, but I felt like Socrates seemed to be going off on his own thing and trying to hold Protagoras to an account of virtue that was so unified,
right,
that it didn't have any ability to make distinctions. And I thought it was almost, I thought it was unfair, I felt, in some way.
It's something of a false dichotomy,
right,
for Protagoras. Yeah, this is another thing that really, it's so interesting, just because the face tends to be an issue in the Protagoras at particular points. When we talk about the face of Hermes, for example, that you point out early on.
Right.
But I think it makes most sense to me to see Socrates baiting Protagoras a little bit and in a way kind of making fun of him, or at least pointing out perhaps the two things that are most valuable to Protagoras himself. There's, on the one hand, there's the money that he gets from plying his trade.
Right, right.
And on the other hand, there is this, there's the face, which to me, I I think we have a couple aspects in the dialogue to see this imagery of the face as a kind of substitute for a kind of pride or a kind of attention that it gets. So just to run that out a little bit.
Do you talk about that in the dissertation?
Yeah, I talk about that a little bit in the dissertation. But since the dissertation, I've had more time to think about it, of course. And there's a point when they agree to have this conversation with Socrates and Protagoras, agree to have a conversation in front of everyone instead of a private conversation.
Right.
And Socrates observes that Protagoras, I think the translation I have is like wanted to put on airs by showing the erotic attachment that Hippocrates and Socrates were showing to him.
Mm-hmm.
But the term there is calopsis thai, which is literally a beautification of the face, which functions as a word of a kind of sort of a pride or a kind of affectation.
Right.
And this term comes up again in the dialogue, precisely in a different sense, when Socrates is said, or I'm sorry, when Protagoras is said to be a little bit coy. It's the same word there. So he's trying to present a particular face that he wants attention called to, and this is a source of real pleasure for him to get the kind of attention or honor that he desires on the one hand, and the money that he makes from it on the other. So I think there's a way of thinking both the gold and the face as two choices that Socrates makes to talk about virtue, two choices that actually bear upon the kind of value system exemplified by Protagoras.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's true. It's a lot. The examples are not accidentally chosen. I hadn't thought about the issue of the real biting nature of the appeal to gold, which is really makes me smile just to think about it. But I'm wondering also about two things about what you mentioned. One is the question of the role of the public, and I'm thinking about that in this dialogue, namely having this discussion in this public way adds a dimension, and what is the dimension that it adds? And maybe this is part of the answer to that, which is this whole discussion that I try to bring in at the end about the relationship between shame and justice,
right?
Which, according to Protagoras' story, Hermes brings to humans at the instruction of Zeus, and that's really where the political begins. That's the fact that we have a sense of shame, and we humans have a sense of shame and a sense of decay, of justice, is what is the moment when human beings become political animals.
Right, right. I loved your observation about that. I'd never thought about that before as Alcibiades playing the role of Hermes by making, or at least calling attention to, Protagoras' shame there. And of course, shame is that one emotion, or maybe not that one particular emotion, but it is an emotion in which you can read it on someone's face.
Right.
As well. So there's the blush of shame, which you also see early on Hippocrates, when Socrates asks him, "Well, wouldn't you be ashamed to face your fellow citizens as a sophist?" And this is where he blushes, and he actually feels shame as well. Right. So that brings in the public there in a particular way. Right.
You've also added this whole really interesting dimension of the face and the relationship between the beautiful face and appearing beautifully, which is really all wrapped up with this, right? I mean, especially since, I mean, just the playful way in which Socrates says that he's doing a favor to the beautiful Callias, and uses the Greek kalos to jingle with Callias and sort of re-inscribes the notion that this is all animated by some sense of the beautiful, and there might be a way in which the publicness and the appearing of us in public adds. Well, of course, that's always been associated with the political. And that's actually something that I've been thinking that Socratic politics actually challenges, which is this rigid distinction between public and private.
Well, and and to talk about your discussion of what it means to come together in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and to have a productive dialogue by two people coming together, also in front of others, where these others also have a role and a stake in the dialogue. It's something that I think you touch on quite nicely. Whereas the role that the others have in the dialogue is not necessarily one of judges, but it's their job to exhort one party or the other to keep to an agreement
mm-hmm.
that two people forge between themselves.
Right.
And of course, what is the effect of this kind of exhortation? Well, if you are, especially if you're someone like Protagoras who has a lot to lose and you're basing yourself on your reputation, if you find that other people need to exhort you to answer or to keep to an agreement, that is automatically going to cause you an amount of shame.
Right. And then shame, I mean, so then shame also has a positive function in the sense of accountability.
Right. It's an essential part of the Elenchus
mm-hmm.
as well, in particular. And this is something that I'm trying to recall his name. There's someone that I went to graduate school with, Rob Metcalf, sorry.
Oh, sure, yeah, Rob, right. Yeah.
I don't know how that name got lost. but he in his dissertation, he really brings out the nice way in the Gorgias, how shame and Elenchus are linked together, essentially. And the Elenchus doesn't seem to have the kind of power that it would if shame were not an issue, if someone did not feel that they had, perhaps despite themselves, despite even what they think of themselves, that they had commitments to the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about Rob because he. You're going to be at the Ancient. You'll be there in April, or are you going to be able to make it out to Michigan State?
Oh, of course, I never miss.
Yeah, I know. So I was assuming you were, but I didn't want to just assume. I think Rob will be there too. It would be fun to see if we could get the three of us together to have another discussion about the question of shame and the Elenchus and this whole issue of the face and the public.
Oh yeah, that would be great. And I'd also like to hear you maybe expand a little bit on the role of Hermes in the dialogue as well, since we bring in the face, because this seems to be the vehicle of talking about Hermes and potentially hermeneutics as well in the dialogue. So I wonder if I could just ask you maybe to say a few more things about what you take the importance of this reference to Hermes to be right at the beginning of the dialogue when Socrates invokes Homer to justify his attachment to Alcibiades.
Right. Well, and I think this might be a good way also to bring it back to the whole question of the hora and the proper time, because, it struck me, first of all, that that Hermes clearly plays a role in Protagoras' speech, but then there's that playful moment at the very beginning of the dialogue where this unnamed friend is ribbing Socrates for pursuing Alcibiades, and then, they make that reference to Alcibiades' beard, or lack thereof, and Socrates refers to Homer, and the reference is to Hermes, namely the question of that Hermes appears as a young man at this most beautiful point in his life. So Hermes. Then I did a little looking into the figure of Hermes as a god, and he's a traveling god. He's the god of the in between, and I thought, okay, now we really have an image that is important if we're thinking about Socrates' life as on a course, or as which Socrates himself says at the end is he's concerned for the whole course of his life.
Right.
And then he's also, Hermes is also the god who presides over the relationships and the dealings with strangers, and I thought that was really important because Protagoras, in a certain sense, is a stranger in Athens, and so this kind of encounter between Protagoras and Socrates, if Socrates is in the presence of a kind of Hermes figure, which I'm basically trying to argue that Alcibiades, in fact, is, that really opens up a new way of understanding sort of what's happening here. And I think the way in which Alcibiades is made at the end to sort of point to Protagoras' shame and really shame him to Callias, you know, what he says to Callias at the end, well, Callias, do you think that that Protagoras is doing well here? And sort of that's the real moment when, you know, you hold Protagoras accountable and you move the dialogue really moved to a different kind of plane. And where we have the whole discussion of what it would mean to speak in one's own voice and what education means and all of that. So I think that that reference to Hermes and the sort of presence of Hermes in the text, it turns out to be really important. I also know that Hermes is the god of thresholds and boundaries, and it always strikes me that, you know, it's at these moments. I mean, in some ways, Hippocrates, I guess I don't really mention this, but Hippocrates is at one of those moments in his life where he needs to kind of decide what's he going to be, who's he going to be, and where is he going to go, and Socrates is there with him in that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that your paper gives us to think is perhaps a way in which shame might actually be a vehicle, a productive vehicle for more dialogue, even when it comes from outside, when it comes from someone who doesn't have necessarily that much of an active role in the dialogue itself. So we tend to think of the experience of shame as something necessarily bad, but it also seems, especially if you're, say, a Freudian or something like this threat of shame is quite useful to us. It in fact helps keep us engaged as a member of a community.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's two points I want to make about that. One is, you know, if you lose the capacity to be playful and to think about and to make mistakes and to laugh at them and to you know, then shame does become this biting, cutting, horrifying thing that undermines your self-confidence. But if you do have the requisite amount of playfulness and the ability to, you know, okay, seem like you don't know something sometimes, that's actually not a bad thing. I think shame can become cutting when you lack that playfulness. But the second thing I would want to mention is that I see this as I begin to think about how I can use the public dimension of technology, and particularly I'm thinking in this regard about blogging with students, because what I notice is that when I require that they and hopefully encourage them to blog in public, even if the public is limited to the classroom, they have a different approach to their own writing than they do when they're just submitting something to me and it's a one-person audience that they're writing for.
Right, so that, yeah, sure, that makes sense.
You know, that when I mention something that they may have gotten slightly wrong or that they have some typos or even factual errors, they jump on that thing and correct it very quickly in a way that's never happened to me when I've, you know, written in the margin of a paper I receive, you know, this is, you know, incorrect, or, you know, they don't come and submit the paper back to me 2 weeks later usually, unless I say, you've got to rewrite this.
Right.
You know, so there is that positive dimension. I think this goes to your point about how that publicness can be a powerful way of maintaining engagement with people.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to a way in which this aspect of sophistry that we see exemplified by Protagoras as in a way kind of pervaded our customary modes of relating to one another.
Mm-hmm.
Where it seems like this notion of playfulness has become rather uncommon.
Right.
So for Protagoras, he's put himself in a position where he can't allow for a lot of playfulness. He can't tolerate a notion that someone might show himself to be wrong precisely because he has put himself forward as the real authority on virtue or on whatever it is he chooses to teach. So any any notion that he might be wrong about something, say the nature of virtue, which is a biggie, is something in which not only does he lose face, he loses money.
Yeah, right, he loses business.
But it also seems to be the case that, and this is something that I talk about with my classes as well, especially my lower division classes, is that it seems to be a natural human tendency to want to protect yourself and show yourself as a kind of authority precisely because this is one of the main ways that you get attention.
Right.
So in order to be seen as someone who's valuable to talk to or consult, you have to seem like you know what you're talking about even when you don't.
Right. Well, and I think that one in thinking about the kinds of the conditions under which that sort of relationship with others, namely one that is playful enough to be able to handle a certain level of shame, or you have to have a certain level of self-confidence. You have to be, it's the most insecure people who are most worried about appearing to be, wrong or. And for whom shame is this cutting, damaging phenomenon.
Right. But even talking in terms of I think that the most secure people are not exactly the least common people. I think that there is a kind of widespread insecurity.
Right.
On the part of a lot of folks today, and I think that's part of living in an information age, but it's also part of a student's experience when they, somewhat like Hippocrates, are in a time of life when they have to attempt to sort of define themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of their energies goes into, I feel like I might get punished for trying to characterize my undergraduates this way, and I don't mean it as a bad thing,
sure.
But the healthy aspect of claiming your own identity.
Right.
Also opens you up to a certain amount of risk,
mm-hmm.
precisely because it's a point in which a lot of people feel as if they need to really take themselves seriously.
Right. Well, and I think that's why the moment at the end of the dialogue where Socrates says, it's really the course of my whole life that I'm concerned about, and as an extension of that, the course of Hippocrates' whole life. I think that this really brings it, I think, nicely back around to this whole question of the time of life and the proper time, and the role that communities of education can play at those moments, as we are so privileged to have with our students, where they're coming to school and they're here to figure out who they want to be and how they want to live. It's a real important time, and it's a kind of real privilege to be able to be part of that. But
right.
And that can be really problematic when the response to that is this kind of dogmatic unidirectional lecturing,
right.
versus the cultivation of the characteristics that would allow students to be able to engage in dialogue throughout their life. So I want to, maybe we can end on that, because this has been a really great conversation, and I really appreciate
it's been great.
You're coming on to turn the tables on me a little bit and ask me some questions.
I think it's a wonderful article, and at least on a couple points that are not inconsiderable, I feel like I really had my mind changed about this dialogue. But there are other things, probably in private, that I'm going to grill you on.
We'll have to put those in public too at some point. But I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in April. We'll have to figure out some time maybe to do a digital dialogue with Rob, and we'll also I'll try to be doing a number of digital dialogues at the Ancient Philosophy Society, because so much of what I'm interested in thinking about and so many of the people I'm interested in talking to are going to be there, so it'll be fun to try and get people together.
Oh, yeah, it'll be great. It'll be it's always a wonderful time, not just to see friends, but to really feel it. It's really an extraordinary thing to be able to get together with a lot of people that you not only like, but that you learn from every time that
right.
you show up.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I'm expecting that you'll maybe be bringing some of your students as well, if you can, to come see how interesting and how fun and
right.
invigorating it can be.
Right, exactly. Well, I'll have to try and convince some of them. So
yeah, that's a challenge to you,
Chris. Exactly. All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Chris.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.